You're tuned into Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, David Nikki Nellis.
Hello.
Howdy do. Nick and I have a broadcast show called Foodie and the Beast on 1500 AM out here out of Washington, and that's more of a food and wine, et cetera, a variety show.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Well, you know, food and wine, brews.
It's a food, wine, travel, and lifestyle
show. Is that
what
that is?
Yes, we've been doing it for the last 9 years,
and we've had...
Really, everybody, not just locally, but also nationally and internationally. We've had Alain Ducasse. We've had Wolfgang Puck. We've had all the locals from the now deceased Michel Richard who we miss and love, to Mike Isabella, Brian Vitaggio. But we also bring on lots of farmers and lots of people in and around the D.C. area who are doing...
You didn't mention Fabio Trabocchi. All right, but more than chefs. It's brewmasters. It's anybody that's involved with the food chain in one way or another, or hospitality. We've had marine biologists. So anyways, that show moves pretty fast. This show is something different. It's a deep dive into a single subject, and we have some pretty interesting folks with us today. They were on Foodie and the Beast with us, and they only had about 7 minutes. Shane and Megan Carpenter own Hex Ferments in Baltimore. They're all about...
They're the people behind Hex Ferments in Baltimore.
Well, they own it, too.
I know, but like... It makes, like, when you say they own it, it makes it sound like a brick
and mortar. I don't
know
that you'd
want to
be behind somebody that was eating something fermented, but that's just
oh.
Who knows? But anyways, and also in is Lane Harlan. She's the owner of W.C. Harlan, which is a great cocktail bar in Baltimore, and Clavo Mezcalaria, which is a restaurant and bar. And she uses a lot of fermented foods on her menus.
Well, actually, Megan is the one who introduced us to her because
Correct.
She thought it would be such a nice component to talk about, like, the health and the goodness of fermented foods and drinks and what they do for you. And then, actually, we can talk to Lane about how they're utilized. So, Lane, let's just start with you quickly. Just give us the run-up. Tell us about W.C. Harlan.
Sure. W.C. Harlan is a very small neighborhood cocktail bar that I opened with my husband about 5 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
And I've known Shane and Megan for quite a long time. And actually when...
I
do remember the days when I'd go to Shane and Megan's house and it looks like a laboratory because there would be bubbling fermented cauldrons all over the living room. This is before they had, of course, a production space. And so I remember all of that.
Is that why Megan's got the broom and the pointy hat? Is that
exactly.
But so when we opened, I naturally wanted to experiment by using a lot of their different flavors of kombucha and cocktails. It makes a really nice alternative to something like soda or ginger ale.
Well, so you brought something with you today.
Yes, I did.
Because you have a lab.
Yes.
And I want to
know. Clavel, yes.
Yeah, so tell us what that means.
So essentially, above my mezcaleria, we created a bar lab because we really wanted to take a culinary approach to experimenting with the cocktail menu. And we didn't have enough space in our kitchen. Our kitchen is very high production. So we said, let's make a kitchen of our own where we can experiment. We can get a Spinzol and start clarifying liquids and fermenting and dehydrating. And one of the things I've done for a very long time is I've made my own recipe of tepache.
Okay.
Tepache is an ancient pineapple wine.
Mm-hmm.
People drink it very traditionally.
From where?
From Mexico.
From Mexico.
It roots to pre-Columbian times. People have actually originally made it with corn.
I was going to say, because nobody thinks of pineapple coming from Mexico.
Sure.
Right?
It sort of evolved.
Okay.
It evolved from corn.
She doesn't know that one floated over from Hawaii.
Right, and they were like, ooh,
started
let's
the
do
whole
this.
Thing
right.
off.
Right so there. They made it out of corn. That makes sense. And
right,
it does
of course.
Make sense that they would try to make some sort of spirit out of
It's an economical way of drinking something using scraps that that is not only good for your tummy, but gives you a nice, happy glow and buzz.
Okay, so how do you make it?
So the way that I make it is I start with a bunch of pineapple scraps. Mm-hmm. I mash them down.
What
so,
do you mean? Like,
so you use the, you want to use the rinds because, yeah, the peels are great because there's lots of good yeast in the peels, and that is what helps get the batch going. So
because of the sugar?
Exactly. So mm-hmm. we've got all of the rinds, we use the pineapple pieces, and I just, a few people in their hands, it's just hand mashing it, letting it ferment under its own juices for a few days. We get that started, and then we incorporate some spices like cinnamon, star anise, piloncillo sugar, mm-hmm. and then we add filtered water, and we let it run its magic.
All right, well, we're going to let you pour that, and then we're going to sort
of...
We're going to encourage you to pour it, and then we're going to get into our talk with Shane and Megan. Let's move those mics over so each of you have
a mic,
so please.
Can we start from the start? First of all, our show is called Foodie and the Beast for a reason, okay? Because I'm a meatball. What do I know? The whole idea of fermented foods, I mean, I get sauerkraut because that's a pretty standard in my, you know, my sort of my experience. But how did it all get started?
Because we're Jewish. We ate sauerkraut.
That's right.
I mean, that's right.
Now let the Jews eat the sauerkraut.
Right, exactly. But
I mean, how do you think it got started? Because fermented foods aren't necessarily the most, understand how I'm saying it, the most appealing by smell or by look when you, you know, if it's 10,000 years ago and something's fermented, you go, I ain't eating that. But yet, not only... did people eat it? But it's good.
How much disagree? When at what point are you all going to start
disagreeing
with him?
No, but I'm trying to go back to
the early days of primordial
ooze.
Okay, so like, what is the so to shorten that?
What are you, my, are you
well,
my
I mean,
mommy?
This is the longest.
You know, I'm asking.
You're like asking the longest
how
question
you figure
ever.
People got into fermented foods.
So fermentation is the oldest form of food preservation, right? Mm-hmm. We would not be here today if it were not for our microbial
friends.
I'm not
sure I want to be here today, but here I am.
Well, you are here
right.
because of microbes. And fermentation was evolved with us. We are just a part of microbes as microbes are a part of us. Mm-hmm. And so think about it. 10,000 years ago or even... 1,000 years ago, you had a farm or you had a community where you needed to eat in times of scarcity. And so, yeah, it's good stuff, isn't it?
Daddy just took a hit of tapache.
I know, it's really yummy.
Not bad.
It is
Daddy
so
like.
Not bad.
Maybe I do want to be here.
Mm-hmm. So you're tasting, like what Lane had said, a brew that was composed of scraps. Because it had a little bit of sugar left on it. And, you know, when you're eating for a community and you don't have, you know, the Whole Foods next door, you have to save everything that you have.
Right.
And so in doing those processes, saving, farming, fermentation co-evolved with the evolution of agriculture. So you have... Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say most all original foods... beer, cheese, wine. What are you drinking in your other cup there?
Coffee.
All used fermentation as a way to achieve both preservation and flavor.
But from the starting point. So, like back as we go back all those years, was it because people left stuff out or they figured it out?
Well, imagine your in the middle of the globe and are a hunting and gathering society, mm-hmm. and you need to follow the food. And as you do, you're crossing the eastern steppes or otherwise, and along the way you've got wild creatures, you have roots and vegetables, you've learned from your experience what is edible, what is inedible. And you've,
she wants to say something.
Go ahead.
We talked about this on the way.
Yes.
Don't worry,
okay.
We're going back to the origin story
so
we have a little more time.
We do have time. We really want to hear this, so go ahead.
Sure. So,
give him a chance, Megan.
Yeah, right. So you've picked all those lovely tubers along the way. You've gnawed what you could gnaw, and you come across a patch that is just lush with, dandelion roots, let's say, You pack them all into a bag, or let's say a goat's bladder.
While it's still in the goat,
you've already delicious. Eaten the goat,
and you probably dried it and
that's an accommodating goat
that as well. And then you eat it in a week as you're traveling, and it tastes a little bit different. You eat it in 2 weeks, it tastes a little bit different still. And then maybe you found another food source for a span of a month, and you go back to the goat's stomach. You're unsure, so this is where we joke, and you send Thor in, and you have him taste it to see what he comes up with.
Like Mikey. Let Mikey eat it. He eats everything, right? Did Mikey like it?
And the goat says, Thor.
And not only did it not off Thor, but he feels better and more vital. And therein is this transformation of fermentation.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, because obviously they didn't know they were eating probiotics. But at what point in history did people start really making that connection that this food is not only good for you? It's good.
Yeah, barely.
Really?
Now.
Well, is that it?
Yeah, it's entwined with our biology, but only now. And this is, fast forward thousands of years from those times of feast and famine, scarcity and abundance, that we've arrived at this now conundrum where we've figured out how to feed people. But
not we're not feeding them healthy.
Sure, we've industrialized and corporatized it in a way to make it shippable, shelf stable, with ultimately a bottom line at the end of the equation, not so much nutrition, although there's more of a balance towards the latter anymore.
Well, go ahead.
I was just going to say that kind of brings us to Hex Ferments.
Well, I feel like we're jumping too far ahead. I mean, I want to get to Hex Ferments, but what I want to understand is how over the years it's evolved and how people, I think about people eating today, and everybody's always afraid about things going bad, right? We're always afraid, like, are the eggs bad? Is the butter bad? Is the milk bad? Right. Do our veggies go bad? Right. Like, everything, has this indeterminate shelf life,
which is why we have such a huge majority of food
food waste, yeah. Right? So I guess that's where I'd like to figure out, at what point can food be fermented, and how do we evolve that? Does that make sense? Can you?
Well, I mean, so when you look at the practice of fermentation, right? Mm-hmm. So it's to have foods over a period of time of scarcity, right? So technically, in the fall, you would put up a big barrel of sauerkraut with your community, or a farmer would do that, and then you would eat through that barrel all winter long, and that would give you vitamin C, it would give you nutrients, it would give you something to help you digest food.
Right.
But for them, it was just something to eat. Whereas now, we have the refrigerator, which is also a fermentation slowing device. We keep everything in there so it doesn't rot.
Right.
But where things started happening and changing was in the industrialization of food. So when foods went from being, something that you would buy from your local market or your local farmer or your local larder, became more you could just go to the store as
and
a convenience.
Anytime. Right.
And then food is being shipped from all over the country, your people then becoming decentralized to their farmer, and that's when that shift I feel like happened, in the 40s and 50s, when people were starting to go to the supermarket and getting foods there.
Well, it's sort of like the demise of canning. Do you know what I mean? People stopped canning the way they used to because they used to have to fill their cellars.
Stuff came in cans.
Right.
Well, and canning's a relatively new process. It's only about 200 years old.
Okay.
Canning was devised to feed soldiers during war. And it just became a process over time with, Louis Pasteur and pasteurization and everything being kind of deadened so that they could ship it to their troops on the battlefield.
That's a great piece of information.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, a lot of the things, cell phones, because of war. Plastic, because of war. So you have this
fertilizer because of the bombs made and war. Yes, all true. Yes.
White flags.
So you have all these housewives, right, that don't have to can food anymore.
Right, exactly.
They can just easily go to the store. And we always like to use Wonder Bread as a symbol because not only were you not slaving in the kitchen, having to wait for your leavens to rise and ferment mm-hmm. properly, you could go to the store, get a loaf of bread. Not only was it good, and I use that.
I mean, please put that in quotes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was sliced. And for people, that was a sign of prosperity.
Mm-hmm.
So you have convenient
and
food
enriched.
As prosperity. And enriched.
That arrived.
Right. Exactly. No, yeah. I understand that. So let's talk about, so here we are. What was it about fermented foods that got you guys turned on? Now kombuchas, are available now.
Mm-hmm.
But 10 years ago, I never even heard the term, and I'm in the food world. It was not a big part of the food space.
Right.
I thought it was a small town in northern Japan, actually.
It might be.
So what got you guys interested? Where did it begin?
Do you want to start with that?
Sure. Well, not unlike our predecessors, an abundance of vegetables really kickstarted it. We were doing a lot of other urban homesteading projects.
What does that mean?
Where
that sounds very millennial to me. I mean, what does that mean?
Sure. So consider the trajectory of technology and society and from whence we've came, increasingly separated from or experiences mediated through technology.
Mm-hmm.
Urban homesteading is an approach to try to realign with some of our more earnest and early sensibilities, like bread making and hand skills and knitting and weaving and all of these things. While living in the city,
okay.
Yeah. There's homesteaders
right.
that do it by means of necessity, whereas typically the urban homesteader is taking it on as more of a intellectual journey.
Well,
I
this
suppose.
Is kind of a new wave. This is one of the very few things I can speak about with authority of hippiedom, because
yeah.
back in the late 60s,
he's an original
and early,
hippie.
Early 70s, I'm an artifact.
Yes.
That was really the thing. It was sort of back to the earth was the phrase.
Right.
But it, I had a friend.
It wasn't
that,
Peace Man? Wasn't it just like Peace Man? Or Tune In,
no,
Tune
peace,
Out?
No,
what
peace,
was it?
Peace. There's a comma in there. Peace.
Oh,
man.
Okay. Well, I wasn't
peace
there.
Peace Man sounds like
I
Aquaman.
I wasn't even born yet.
Or Superman. Man.
Right.
No, you're a zygote, I
yes.
think. All right. So, but it was like that. It was, I had a friend that was, she was all about quilting, and I had somebody that had a loom. In her room in her house.
Yeah.
It's all about being sort of fighting being alienated from what's real versus what's sort of, the matrix,
And I feel like, so as fermentation practices our cycles, we go through generational cycles, especially at times of great change. And I feel like 60s, 70s, like that was a
it was
era.
A big upheaval.
Yeah, we had the civil rights movement, we had
the war,
we had,
another
people
war.
Becoming,
right?
Displaced from their families in that way, and a huge boom in different technologies. And we're experiencing that same thing now.
Well,
and
it really kind of started, though, after the collapse of the economy in 2008. When the economy collapsed, a lot of people were like, starting gardens again, mm-hmm. and people were...
Listen,
were,
chickens in the backyard in
right.
Chevy Chase.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
goes
people,
back to Victory Gardens.
Exactly, right. But people wanted to have their own eggs,
mm-hmm.
and I think that a lot of this craft artisanship that started after the collapse of the economy really had a lot to do with people being like, no, we're going to make it ourselves. And as a way to save money, but then realizing, look at all these new businesses that have now happened. Do you know what I mean? You have the union kitchens and the mess halls of this world where people who probably could never launch a product because they couldn't afford a factory or to work in a big industrial kitchen can now
incubate
yeah. and do it. So the bad news brought us good news.
But I also think, not to get too deep into it, you get this feeling of being disconnected to the world. And if you listen, God in heaven, if you listen to the news, it's like everything's going to shit in a bucket. So what's real and what feels good and what can you
right.
do right. knead that bread and bake that bread and smell that bread and eat that bread that you baked, you know, that's about as...
It's a feeling of security.
Yeah.
And be elbow deep in kimchi, it's pretty nourishing.
Okay, having not done that. So, okay, what...
That actually sounds... Wait. I think that could be another show. It sounds a little kinky.
Elbow okay, yeah. deep?
So, having not done that, what was the first... What was the first thing that you played with?
Well, I just want to kind of go back, if I could.
Of course.
So both Shane and I grew up in the upper Midwest, where both our parents hunted and fished and preserved. And, you know, my parents were late generation hippies, and they had the house.
Meaning they're
the,
older
with
than
the
you.
Ducks.
No, no.
And
they're younger than I am, right?
The like...
How old are your parents?
Early 60s.
Yeah, they're older. I mean, you're young. You're older.
Yeah, I think you should just be quiet. Okay. And keep going.
So anyway, go ahead.
But then I grew up also eating, you know, industrialized food in combination with stuff that my dad went out and shot and, you know, prepared or mm-hmm. fished and prepared and that my mother canned. And I remember as a little kid going to my grandparents' house and seeing all the pickled things in the cabinets and being kind of mesmerized by the idea of having a garden and then taking what you grew in that garden and then eating from it.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that's what's behind our niece, Julia, teaches urban gardening to disadvantaged kids in inner city school systems where they don't even see fresh produce half the time. You know, their parents are shopping at convenience stores because in many places that's all there is. And they say, you know, that miracle when the kid actually puts a seed in the ground, nurtures it, grows it, harvests it, and cooks it and eats it, it's like...
It's transformative.
Mind-blowing,
just
right.
Just like super. Fermentation. It's transformative. It keeps us rooted and connected, and even kids that aren't disadvantaged lose that connection to the soil and what it means to grow. And so when
our kids go to Chipotle, we should tell them to grow their own food.
Okay.
It's a balance. You know?
It's a total balance. It is.
Especially as the industrialization of food grows increasingly consolidated and corporatized. But
don't you feel that the trend that you're... all of you are on right now? I mean, this is a huge... Not just the foods that you're making, but like there is a trend to go smaller and for people to come up with these products and they should stay small. I mean, if they become huge, then don't we lose what they really are? I mean, you want it to be a thrivable business, but the whole point is to have these small offerings to what?
Well, okay,
to have them to people.
Keep going. I want to go back to Lane because, you know, you've worked with their kombucha, I guess, and other products, but you've got this lab in your place and you're experimenting with all kinds of stuff. And listen, you know, people who were in the cocktail business 15 years ago were just trying to figure out, you know, which mixture of alcohol and fruit juices.
That's not true.
Many, 20 years ago. My point is they weren't putting kombucha in cocktails 20 years ago. So,
well, I don't think there was a lot of kombucha to be found 20 years ago.
You're trying to make drinks that are good, but also they're healthy.
Absolutely. And I mean, at every bar now, you'll see a lot of people, I mean, good bars, craft cocktail bars.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see people having now low, you know, spirit-free cocktails, low ABV cocktails. People still want to gather and go out and maybe not even necessarily have a mixed drink. Maybe they want to drink a tall glass of kombucha and have a nice conversation with their friend who happens to be drinking beer.
Well, don't you think, I mean, like, shrubs are back. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's lot of shrubs.
Right, and these punches. Like, there's all these, like, a shrub, years ago, you wouldn't find one in a bar. Years and years ago, you would find one.
Only in a Monty Python movie.
No, okay. But do you know what I'm saying? Like, you're finding all these tonics and different products that were pre-prohibition, excuse me, you know, that people utilized.
There's
in
a lot of free flow of information, and people, I feel, have the tools to can you hear me now?
Yes.
I feel that they have tools and the brains and the means to make their own things. Why not?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel myself getting closer and closer to not wanting to even buy spirits that are brands and to just take something and infuse it a million times and make it something different and not have to have 50 spirit brands behind my bar because I know that I could do that if I wanted to do that. And I just think some people feel like they're floating in space with all the brands and the sort of corporate Diageos of the world that own a million things that say they're craft and they're not. People just want to do their own things.
Well, I think it's hard because I think that I sort of have a foot in both of those worlds. Do you know what I mean? Because sometimes some of those products are good. So it doesn't mean you shouldn't use it. But if you can make it on your own, you know, and you want to, there's nothing wrong with it. But I, you know, for me, it feels like, you know, years and years ago, the access was not there. You didn't have the access to make these kinds of products. So now that you can certainly do it. But it doesn't always mean that there isn't a decent one or a really good one out
there. And I mean, W.C. Harlan, for example, the bar was really based on a love for Amaro. And if you look at some of the great Amaros, I mean, they could be completely corporate, like a Fernet Branca.
Right, exactly.
It's beautiful. It'll always be beautiful. It'll always be the best, the most functional digestif there is.
Right.
But it still doesn't mean that because it's a brand, it means it's a good Amaro, or because you make your own Amaro, it's not as good as a Fernet Branca. It's just different, and I think that it's
fun. So wait,
fun.
Are you making your own Amaro?
Oh, we've been making our own Amaro.
Have you really?
Since, oh, yeah.
That's wild.
Everybody that works at W.C. Harlan has their own Amaro, even the bussers.
Really?
Yes.
And how come you didn't bring us some Amaro?
No, I'm just joking. Hey, if you want to talk Amaro or Mezcal, I'm here for another time.
She'll bring it tomorrow. All right, we're going to take a break.
Oh, are we going to take a break now?
All right, take a break.
This is David and Nikki Nellis. We are Industry Night with Booty and the Beast. We're going to be digging into some kombucha in just a little bit.
We're back on Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast on Full Service Radio. The show's live. If you want to listen to it later down the road, it's a podcast at fullserviceradio.org. And Shane, let's go. Well,
you didn't say where we're live from.
We're live from the Line Hotel, the fabulous Line Hotel.
Very fancy.
Which is the new and beautiful boutique hotel here in Adams Morgan. We spent the night here Friday night.
We did.
We had a boom, boom time. It was fun.
Somebody had a boom boom time. Anyway.
Yeah, I was asleep. She had a boom boom time.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice.
I feel taken advantage of, but I don't mind. All right. So, but let's get back to you guys. So you.
Well, let's get back to Hex Ferments.
Yes, let's get back to Hex Ferments. I'm making the gross assumption that people are actually listening to the whole show.
Okay. Well, so.
But so you guys are fermenting and you're kind of doing your millennial hippie thing. What?
There's no negative there.
There's no negative.
No negative.
Peace and love. Peace and love. But my question is, what happened? What was the epiphany or the moment where you turned to each other and said, let's make a business out of this?
Did you start at farmers markets? Where did you go?
So I started making kombucha in my dorm room at Minneapolis College of Art and Design.
So industrious.
2001.
Okay.
And I had traveled to Ireland and hung out with some pretty cool musician people and had a little too
Don't
much
be jealous,
to
Shane.
Drink
it's okay.
the night before. And the next morning there was this weird vat of stuff in their kitchen. And I said, what is that? And in his Irish brogue, he said, kombucha. I can't do the Irish brogue. But he
That's okay.
said,
David will try later.
You it'll wouldn't be help. From Ireland, which
It'll help you with your fuzzy head. And so he actually poured out a bunch into a bottle for me, and I took the bus back home, and it made me feel so good. And at the time, I was working at a
Define co-op. So good. What did it mean?
Like, my body, like... Well, you know, when you drank too much, you feel like, I can say shit, right?
Right, you can.
So you feel like shit. And it just, I could feel like my body tingling.
How much did you have to drink in order to feel?
I just had like a cup, you know, like 9 ounces or so. And it was sour, and I love sour. And it was more sour than sweet. And it had a little fizz to it. But I just
it made me feel a lot better, and it made me clear my head. And while you're in Ireland and you're eating a lot of potatoes and
heavy
brown
food.
Bread, I was having a little difficulty in the other regions of my body, and it helped me to digest.
Mm-hmm.
And while at that same token in Minneapolis, I was working at a co-op where we were making
sauerkraut
and
kimchi. I was
going to
say which regions, but I think
kimchi.
We know.
Right.
Can you say poop on
that? Right, you can say poop. You can say poop.
Yeah. Anyway. All right. And we were making very simple sauerkraut and kimchi from a very small little zine that was put out by Sander Katz, who is mm-hmm. now world-renowned fermentation revivalist. He's a James Beard winning. But at the time, it was a small little zine. And then I just kept making these things throughout my 20s.
Okay. So not really, like, you knew it made you feel better, but you weren't thinking, like, this is so healthy of me.
I mean, like, people were taking probiotic supplements for IBS.
Did you go to a doctor and
like
say,
that.
Why does this make me feel so good? Or do any research? Or you just said...
No, but my grandmother said, oh, it's because it's fermented. It's going to help your body digest food. She didn't know why.
Right.
And then when Shane and I had met, we both kind of bonded over the fact that he had some kimchi sitting in his refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
That gets the girls every time, doesn't it? Slap some under each arm and away you go.
Open that up.
That's right. Hey, baby.
Smell this.
It used to be, you want to come see my etchings? Now it's you want to come have some kimchi.
We could smell that. Yeah.
Radio moment.
Let's see.
Opening
smell
the kimchi.
So he had it, and you said, okay.
But it smells good. I mean, it's a funky smell. You don't want it to, like, permeate your house, but it does smell
well,
good.
Yeah.
Which it did.
Which it has. Yeah. It still does sometimes.
No, we'll come over right away.
Looping back to what Lane had said, yeah, we just had, you know, so an abundance of vegetables. We were involved in two community gardens,
mm-hmm.
one now with 60 families that it feeds. With the surplus going to soup kitchens,
mm-hmm.
and another with about 15 families that it feeds. So a substantial amount of produce being kicked out of these vegetable gardens in our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
But we would come home just with way more than we could eat at one time.
Mm-hmm.
So we started making kimchis and sauerkrauts and sour pickles and experimenting with all of these really nutritive additions to it, ashwagandhas and black seed and
what's ashwagandha?
It's
like related to ginseng.
Okay.
but some of the same healthful benefits, but grown.
So were you doing research?
Did
you need some assistance as you came up with the layering of the things you wanted to add?
Most of it was trial and error, so not unlike our predecessors. But I'd worked on farms, and we grew up around agriculture, although, urban lives. I lived in South Dakota, but with farms on two sides.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I left the Midwest, I went to work in Europe on farms, woofing, which is an acronym for Willing Workers on Organic Farms. And at the time...
Right. Did you have your goat bladder with you?
I had
the hat that you were trying to make.
Yeah, I sheared sheep and carded and darned wool.
Boy.
Got halfway through a hat that I made the yarn for.
You're speaking a foreign language. I mean, I know you're speaking in English, but like...
Have you ever heard of Neiman Marcus? What the hell is the matter with you?
So I did hear of that in a big way because I moved away from all of that. Well, I ended up... I tried to stay in the natural world. I studied bears in Montana and followed them around, grizzly bears.
Mm-hmm. And their poop.
I was called Scat Man, so I would pick up bear poop. Poop again.
Can you answer? Does a bear actually poop in the woods?
They do. And
they actually shit in the woods, in case you wanted to know.
Wait, because I've seen the commercial with the bears on the toilet paper. I thought they just took a shit in the toilet.
And they rub trees, and they do all these really amazing things. And I studied wolves. Then I was a wilderness ranger. And then I became decidedly of the natural world in my profession.
You look like and it's a compliment. 18.
It's so fermented
cool.
food.
When was
it's
this?
Right, fermentation.
That's right.
Clean
I used
living.
To bathe in kombucha,
yeah.
And now I'm young.
But and then I after I moved to Seattle, I lived just a very urban existence, getting out once in a while. And this in tandem, kind of like what we had talked about, which is the rise of technology and maybe disassociation, and perhaps I was prone to that. So that when moving to Baltimore, despite its uber urban urbanity, I began to seek out more of these life skills. Mm-hmm. And it turns out my life mate, unbeknownst to me, was doing the same thing.
Does
Megan know about your life mate? She'll be here later.
Yes.
She's part two of this show.
The lactobacillus that you... Yeah. Well, what's so wonderful... So when Lane says we go way back, we do go way back. So Lane's now husband was Shane's neighbor.
Okay.
And so Lane's husband, Matthew... I'm
glad it doesn't rhyme with Lane and Shane.
Knew about, what we were doing.
Right.
And so when we were doing, like what Lane said, like all the crocks and carboys bubbling in our kitchen, we'd have them over for dinner. They were talking about, opening a bar. And Lane was like, well, you're already working on these fermented foods. You should really open a business. And I was like, Lane, I'm not doing that.
Well, so let's get to that. I mean, how did you wind up with a product?
Well, wait, can I jump in? How did you figure out that there was a market for it out there? Because the product's one thing, packaging's one thing, but... feasibility of it.
Can we get to all of them? Because the show's only an hour.
But I mean, let's get, that's really the thing. Let's start a business. Does anybody else out there give a poop if we have all this stuff?
That's the scary part of starting a business. And mm-hmm. I had a very secure job at the Maryland Institute College of Art, where I was an adjunct faculty and an administrator, but deeply unsatisfied, and would come home and use my studio as my kitchen. And Shane was also... feeling the need to be more tangible from being a photographer. Mm-hmm. And I ended up losing my job. And that was sort of the kick in the pants that said, all right, we're going to do this.
So what was it that you were going to do?
Because we're going to start Baltimore's first fermented foods company.
And did you know that you were going to offer kombucha and krauts and kimchi?
We wanted to do it all.
You wanted to do it all. So yep. You knew ahead of time.
We knew we wanted to do it all. And with said daytime job, sorry, Micah, but right. I used most of my days researching how to get a license and become a legitimate business. Because we'd research doing just home swapping, and I'm like, I don't want to do that. I want to make this a legitimate business.
Home swapping?
Yeah, where people come to your house and you swap goods, or people come to your house and buy. There's this whole food market.
There's Spike. His new place is opening. Hi, Spike.
This is a very distracting fish bowl.
It's weird, wow. Right? I know.
So actually, it's really funny. We're kind of bookended by two helpful people here.
Right?
Lane and Spike.
Because Spike carries your products.
Well, not only that, but so when I lost my job, my first day of unemployment was actually giving a presentation to the, Baltimore? At WC.
Okay, so how did we get it in the jar?
Well, we're getting there.
Okay.
So we decided that we had to come up with three products.
Mm-hmm.
We actually don't refer to them as products. We refer to them as goods or creations.
Okay.
And so we used our friends as test subjects.
Right.
And we would have people over for dinner. Mm-hmm. And we would make a really nice meal, and then we would just line them all up and kind of go through. And people would be like, man, that's okay. That could use a little bit more of this.
Right.
And so people love the kombucha. That's an easy sell. It's sweet. It's fizzy.
Tell people what, for people who, the uninitiated, what is kombucha?
So kombucha is a fermented tea.
Okay.
That uses a culture called a symbiotic community of bacteria and yeast.
That sounds delicious.
SCOBY.
Mm-hmm.
And that SCOBY then eats the tannins and the nitrogen and the sugars and everything that's in that tea.
But it's not tea in the classical sense. You don't use tea leaves.
You use tea leaves.
You do.
Use Camellia sinensis.
Yep, okay.
To make it ferment. And mm-hmm. it needs that structure.
How long does it take to ferment?
Anywhere from a week to 10 days.
Is it the same thing for the tapache?
Tapache takes some, so it depends on how big, I don't know how, you probably have pretty big fermenters, but
yeah.
We're 5 days to a week.
Okay, great. All right. So, and then, but it comes in flavors.
Yeah. So we were experimenting, you know, we had lots of herbs from the gardens. We were putting in like whole peppers and leaves, you know, herbs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we weren't kind of hip to bottle conditioning nuances just yet. So we were, you know, finding out about, you know, how much we could put in there, kind of balancing flavor. And we just kept really good notes on everything. And my grandmother made juniper caraway sauerkraut. Mm-hmm. And so we had that one. We had that recipe down. And then trying to find a space in Baltimore is kind of difficult. We didn't have a food incubator. So I...
Yeah, you're like just before that time.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like now it's so different. But you're just, you started... Like, right, like,
and even
almost like a year before
a food incubator, we probably still wouldn't have been able to because Baltimore City didn't allow, we're considered a food processor. We were illegal in Baltimore City at the time.
So what'd you need, FDA approval?
Nope. So we needed the okay from the state, but in
and
order
zoning
to...
issues.
And zoning issues. So we got a commercial kitchen, but found out after we got it, that it actually wasn't in the zoning profile for food processing, though the state had given us the okay.
Okay.
And so those areas for food processing were like heavy industrial zones.
Right.
And very expensive. Not affordable.
Where we'd like to be.
For a husband and wife trying to build a business.
Right.
So the state allowed me to operate out of this kitchen in the basement of a church while we figured out our licensing and zoning with the city.
Mm-hmm.
It just so happened at the same time in that fall that the city, one, approved cottage industry laws, which were non-existent before in Maryland, and retail food processing. So retail food processing is exactly what it is, where
right.
you can process, but you have to have a retail space in the same space.
Which you guys have.
Which we had. So we didn't have that, though, until we did Union Graze, which was a farmer's market that was at Artifact Coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Spike started that, and we were there, Gingy's Pure Chocolate.
Out in the parking lot every weekend?
It was in the courtyard behind Artifact. Have you
right.
been? It's really
yeah.
sweet back there.
It's beautiful.
And that's where we discovered people were hungry for what we were making,
okay.
and we were selling out.
So they knew about
week.
It, and they were, oh, kombucha.
People were getting hip to it. They quite weren't there yet, but...
But kimchi was starting to already have... You know,
yeah.
this like resurgence or introduction, let me put mm-hmm. it to you that way,
mm-hmm.
to the States. Do you
yeah.
know what I mean? Like Korean food became very, very popular in New York City and on the West Coast, you know, and it was sort of trickling across the country at this point. So
mm-hmm.
people knew what kimchi was.
And people definitely have their stories of kimchi. So mm-hmm. we were fielding a lot of questions and stories and getting to know people through that market,
mm-hmm.
which was really great.
Well, so... Let's just talk about the kombucha flavors, because
mm-hmm.
I'm sort of curious. Like, what are the flavors that you offer?
Just a quick aside.
Of course.
As far as the stories go, it was so fascinating, because with our farmer's market, in a way that I hadn't before, we were just interfacing with people about food in such a lively, spirited, meaningful way. It was really infectious,
mm-hmm.
and that informed a lot of why... We were doing what we were doing and continue to this day. And the stories that people would come back with or just still come to us with are always really connective tissue and like ways to relate. But on the way here in the Uber, how about that guy? We
right.
had a whole conversation about Rocky. A fermented and distilled spirit from Albania.
Which mm-hmm. they drink in Turkey like soda pop.
Right.
Yes.
yes. Exactly.
And
yes.
it's
like,
strong.
But when you find these...
What's it made? What is it? I don't even know what
grapes.
It's from.
It
grapes.
Is grapes,
yeah.
but it's fermented, right?
So it's sort of like
yes.
grappa?
Fermented
yeah.
grapes and then distilled.
Yeah.
But let me...
I
want to jump in with something because we still have some time, but let's talk specifically about the health benefits and about what happens when you... Like, how much kombucha should you drink every day?
Well, we're not doctors.
No, I mean, what's, you know, what makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on your inner ecosystem to which it's being introduced.
I refer to it as my guts, but
your microbiome. Yeah, the 10-to-1 outnumbered ratio of non-human to human cells in your body that govern everything from metabolism, digestion, to brain function, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So, but like a glass of kombucha a day.
Start small and see how your body reacts. That, you know, if you're thirsty and you have a diverse microbiome and you're not introducing a lot of new microbes into your forest, then you probably wouldn't have any issues. If you are you eat primarily dead food and this is the only live thing you've eaten, then you would probably
what other live things would you eat?
Yogurts, water and dairy kefirs, real yogurts. I mean, we could, that's a whole other show.
Right. But you guys don't make yogurt.
No.
Okay.
Pulque, tepache, if you're in Mexico. I wanted to say that there was one time I asked Megan, I said, you know, how much kraut should I be eating a day so that it will be effective for me? And what she said was, well, it's not necessarily the amount. It's more that you eat a little bit every day and you don't skip days. You just eat a little bit every day.
Right,
just keep it in your system.
Right? It's like
and I thought that was amazing advice to just incorporate a little bit every day. Don't go ham on eating like a whole thing of kraut at once. You'd probably be feeling really weird.
But in other words, the way people, because I think it's important, listen, and I'm one of them, people who are not like really going to do their research and not, you know, they want to feel better, they want to be better, but they aren't going to dive in and find out about that ecosystem that's in there.
Well,
so should you have a glass every morning the way most people have a glass of orange juice?
Okay, so I think some people do, but I think what they're saying is that it's important to incorporate live microbes into your body in every day, and you will find the right balance of it.
Right. Well,
because like if I have a spoonful of like the hex ferments, like I told her, because we have some of them. We have some of the glow that you guys just won. They just won the Good Food Awards, by the way. So yay, congratulations. But we have the glow in the house. I'm like, I just take a spoonful during the day because you're just, it's just maintaining. Do you know what I mean?
Well, that's what I'm asking for the people who actually are listening.
Okay.
And if they want to try this, they should start with a, you know, like 6 ounces a day and
starting where it goes. Small, but all in the context of food as medicine. And that's a big part of why we do what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Nourishing, optimal ingredients, no shortcuts. And
so don't eat Big Macs all day and then expect this to help.
Yeah, that's not going to work.
I mean, it probably
would help. Yeah. But it's not going to
I don't know. I think McDonald's is its own laxative, all on its own.
No, no.
That's a whole other
show. But it's not just about pooping. It's about what
healthy,
it does for you.
But it's about healthy pooping.
So kind of going back to the origin story a little bit. So we had the opportunity to become retail food processors and open up a brick and mortar in Belvedere Square Market. And thanks to Spike ushering in and getting us in there. And that's when we really knew what we were doing was real. And that's when we really had to become like, okay, we have to get our processes down. We have to become legitimate with everything that we do. And we found out that we were the only, and we still are, the only brick and mortar fermented foods company that you can come to 7 days a week and try over 36 different fermented things in our store. So when we were interacting with the public in this way, we found so many people coming to us with their health concerns.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we even had a disclaimer on the case saying, we are not nutritionists, we are not doctors, we do this for food. This is a food, this is flavor. But we had to become educated pretty quickly because people were coming in and being like, so I went home and I ate a jar of garlic oregano kraut, it was delicious, I ate the whole jar. Well, you shouldn't do that. And so you really need to, like Lane said, I told her, incorporate every day because it's not a quick fix. We're a country that is built on quick fixes.
Right.
And so in order to really have this work, you have to eat it every day. And you really should eat it with food.
Well, there's another revenue stream. Hook up with a nutritionist.
Right.
Sure. We do now. Yeah, we do now. We have that in acupuncturists and, you know, naturopaths and even doctors.
Because what you guys are really doing is... it's really a way of life. It's a lifestyle. I mean, you probably didn't create this to be a lifestyle brand, but it is a way of living healthy. And that's what you're trying to convey to people.
Or even just convey to people that a little bit of a little bit of controlled rot in your life is a good thing, and to not be afraid of things going bad or tasting different.
Well, so can I ask a stupid question? And Lane, I want to get back to you in just a sec, but so can kimchi go bad?
No.
Ever?
No, because it is bad.
No, but that's right? My... Do you know what I mean?
It's fermented. It's good bad.
Can it go bad? Or like, can kombucha go bad?
It would take years.
Okay. I was just
It'll
curious.
Change.
It'll change.
It changes. And we interrupt the ferments so that they're at a place where we and most of our customers enjoy them. Mm-hmm. And then getting back to how much should I eat and what's a good amount and what volume. But again, keeping it in context, that this is how humans have eaten for thousands of years until recently. Mm-hmm. And so much, we believe, of degenerative and disease is by way
but
of...
If it that's probably true. It's a different kind of disease.
What we put in our bodies, including...
But how do you account for... Well, never mind. I answer my own question. Because longevity is related to medical care and a lot of other things, too.
But how are we the... We have the same lifespan as our neighbors in Mexico, yet we have the ivory towers of medicine and all of our technological advances.
Oh, it's Donald Trump's fault.
Okay. Oh, I mean...
Let's move on, shall we? All right, can we get the mic over to Lane? Because, Lane, I want to talk about what you're doing at WC Harlan, because you do have this really interesting craft cocktail bar where you're experimenting and doing things, and you have the lab on top of Clavel. Mm-hmm. So... How are you playing with things? And I mean, you're fermenting things. Were you inspired by Megan and Shane, or was this something that you already had your hands in as well?
Oh, I'm always inspired by Megan and Shane.
Okay.
They are just some of the most driven, organized people I've ever met. Mm-hmm. So yes to that. Some of the things we do in the bar lab, for example, we had a cocktail on the menu. It was a big classic cocktail at Clavel called the Santa Sandia. Pretty simple. We garnished it with basil. Well, you can't get basil year-round. We're having issues with that. The basil would be wilty in the winter, mm-hmm. yada, yada. So we realized, okay, well, if we can get some sort of greenhouse basil that we turn it into an oil instead of putting the herbs on the drink, we can garnish it with the oil, and it'll smell, have the same aroma, and it won't affect the taste. Mm-hmm. We started, we got a Spinzol centrifuge. And then we started basically...
Is that what they have like on CSI? You know, when you watch CSI?
It looks like that. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
They always spin something.
That's it. But once they spin something, we turn the TV off.
It's finding creative solutions to problems, and also just being ahead of the game, experimenting, having fun. There's no reason why in restaurants the kitchen has to be so separated from the bar. I mean, you're creating in both places. You're being conscious of ingredients in both places. And we pretty much sell drinks and food 50-50. So I see in a lot of concepts the bar sort of not following the same standards as the kitchen or vice versa. And I just don't see so much of a divide there. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we needed our own kitchen for our bar.
Okay. So how often in the course of a week do you experiment with stuff and go, this is shit, and then you go, eureka! We found it.
A lot of things are a work in progress. I mean, we change the menu seasonally, but to maintain the menu, we have people in the bar lab just twice a week. And that's what we can afford with our bar program because, they're not making tips up there. Right. So I do it in a sustainable way, what's sustainable for us. Now, when we change a menu, there's a lot of experimenting going on because at one point I said, I don't want to garnish with chili salts. I want to make my own chili salts. I want to make them like in a pestle and mortar like they do in Mexico. And so we started going crazy with different salts, and that's where you need a dehydrator. So we started dehydrating things, taking our own chilies with different types of salts, putting them in a grinder and grinding them down with dehydrated mangoes and herbs and cacao nibs and things. And we just realized the sky's the limit. And this is the funnest we've ever had behind the bar.
So, let me ask you a question. So when you're making those kinds of things, is it at that point that you look at Shane and Megan and say, hey, I should bottle this, or I should, make my own, canister of this and sell it?
In a way, when you make something that you think is so delicious and so good and makes so much sense, and you realize guests are starting to say, is it possible to get your shrub at carry out? I want to take it home. I'm right. Like, can I have the recipe? I'm like, oh, no, just put it here. We'll empty that tequila bottle, throw it in there, give it to them $10. And then you start to realize, oh, this is a product. So, that's not something that I'm considering in the moment. But I would at least for our guests like to pre-packaged things. You know, we sell growlers of tepache, for example. And I think it starts there. But if it's popular and people can't live without it, then of course I'm going to be a yes woman.
What kind of permitting do you have to go through to be able to do that?
I think it's a retail production, kind of like what Shane and Megan have.
Right.
Pretty cool.
But now that you guys already have that, do people come to you all the time and say, hey, carry our product? I mean, you already have the license, so you're ahead of us. Do you know what I mean? Like, do people come and ask that their products be carried with your products?
No.
Not really,
no.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just sort of curious.
We actually, for the first time this year, since our storefront has a retail aspect, mm-hmm. for the first time we're actually going to open it up to shelf-stable local products.
I mean, don't you think that kind of makes sense? So off air we were talking about cooking with kimchi and krauts.
Yeah.
And I was sort of curious, you know, does it take away from the medicinal benefits of the kimchi and kraut when you cook it or heat it up in any way?
Yeah, when you boil it or bake it, you're going to kill off any of the live bacteria, mm-hmm. Which is why
but it still tastes good.
But exactly, you're imparting all the flavor. So if you think about kimchi, like the miso kimchi, it has chickpea miso, it has, you know, garlic and ginger and onions and Napa cabbage, and then all that lovely lactic acid flavor. It's just going to enrich the dish even more.
Mm-hmm. You just don't want to eat kimchi on your first date.
Can you give them the peanut butter recipe?
Oh, let's do
I think people should know about that.
What's the peanut butter recipe?
It's really easy.
Hurry, because we only have a couple
minutes
left.
Kimchi, add peanut butter.
That's it?
There's
Which
derivations
kimchi?
Of that.
Which kimchi?
Ours, miso, chickpea miso kimchi.
Okay.
But another great one is a peanut sauce with rice noodles, and then you just put the kimchi and
that
the peanut
delicious
sauce
too.
Over rice noodles
that sounds amazing.
And greens. We eat that one a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's so many ways. Think about it as another ingredient that you can cook with. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've got a salad dressing that you want to add a little bit of sour to, think of adding a little bit of the sauerkraut juice or a little bit of the sauerkraut itself. Put it on a salad. Put it on your sandwiches.
It's like, I just don't think it's a condiment at the end of the day.
It is,
do you know what I mean?
And
I think there's so many cultures that have condiments as a part of their tablescape.
Yes.
And America really doesn't.
No,
do you know what I mean?
No.
Like Mexico does, and you know, China and Korea, like they all have, South America, like everybody has all these different sauces and condiments to add. And
because
we
food
don't.
Is simple, because we don't really keep food simple. We think of cooking as it has to be this overly complicated mess where you've got all these different tools and equipment and knife skills. No, the best food is the most simple food that you buy at the farmer's market that you prepare simply, and then dress it up with local vinegars and local kimchi and probiotic dusting powders and a glass of tepache from Clavel, and like, you know, do it up. Like eat
this
good,
woman is
food.
A credit to her hippie forebearers. I will tell you. Really.
All right, well, we are out of time. So wait, I want everybody. So first, you guys are at farmers markets locally.
Yep.
Right, you're with Fresh Farm. Mm-hmm. Which ones?
DuPont and Silver Spring,
they're year round. Yep. Saturday, Silver Spring. Sunday,
DuPont.
Where can we find your brick and mortar?
In Baltimore at Belvedere Square Market, 529 East Belvedere Avenue.
And you're at hexferments.com?
Hexferments.com, where we have a map.
Great.
Do you have a store online, too?
We do soon. We have all of our offerings listed and for sale online soon in the near-ish future.
Okay, right. And Lane, take the mic. All right, so Lane, you brought in such deliciousness today. Thank you for introducing us.
Thank you for having me.
And tell everybody where they can find you, please.
Yes, WC Harlan and Clavel, they're one block from each other.
Mm-hmm. In Baltimore.
In Baltimore, Maryland, in the neighborhood called Remington, very close to Johns Hopkins University.
Okay, and where can we find you online?
www.barclavel.com.
Great. All right. We want to thank you all for educating us today.
You.
And our guts are going to be super healthy because we all drank a ton.
I feel like I could live at least another day. I feel good.
Right.
Well, you have to drink more then.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
We want to thank you all for joining us today. And we want to thank our listeners for joining us as well.
Do we know what's happening next week?
Yeah. Next week we have Michael Weissman. She just wrote a fabulous article for the Washington Washington Post about coffee. So we're going to bring in her.
She is one of the preeminent coffee experts in the world.
Yeah, she's amazing. So she's going to come in and we're going to talk coffee with her. And I think she's bringing in a coffee specialist. So it's going to be a terrific show.
Now you're talking.
Yes. We want to thank you all for joining us today on Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. Have a delicious week.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.